scrape those keys together while you stand far enough away, you will not hear noise. So there's lots of misunderstanding of what goes on in here. NASA calls that, let me drop. Metal, intrinsic metal junctions, MIM junctions. The first time they experienced it was during the Mercury program. During Apollo, for sure. During Apollo, they experienced it where the Goldstone dish is aimed at the command service module that's going around the moon, listening to a relatively weak signal when it's on the Omni antenna, and bursts of wind are blowing at Goldstone, California, moving the dish and moving the metal plates against each other that are riveted on that 260-foot diameter dish. As the metal plates were moved past each other, because they were transmitting an uplink signal of 10 kilowatts into that dish on frequency A while listening on frequency B. It's a full duplex, it's a full repeater system, you could say. The Apollo command module is a kind of repeater system. It's a coherent feedback system. The uplink signal is divided and multiplied by 240 over 221 ratio, an irrational number, so to speak. Well, it's rational, but it has no other devices. It's a kind of a prime number. And so 121.5, oh, that's not 121.5. 2287.5 megacycles comes down, 2106.4. 2106.4 is the 10 kilowatt transmit frequency. 2287.5 was the downlink receive frequency. And there was no crystal on board the command service module that did that frequency translating. It was a simple divide-multiplier circuit. The reason they do that is so that they count every cycle of what goes up, count every cycle of what comes down. No local oscillator is involved. They therefore can do very precise ranging. At a quarter of a million miles, they can resolve a fraction of a meter of range rate change or range difference, absolute range difference, with that coherent repeater system. So, in that particular case, they were transmitting 10 kilowatts of power not very far away in frequency, and as the metal plates of the dish were rubbing against each other, it was making bursts of noise in the receiver. And so corrective action had to be applied to that dish to stop that section, that factor from happening. There, the metallic objects were being lit up with a strong local signal. I wonder if that makes more sense, Howie. Back to you, K2LIW. Okay, maybe Howie got called away. George, did you want to make a comment? Are you back in range? WA2VNV, K2LIW.
I hope so. You copy me here now, okay?
You're sounding beautiful. You're full blast on my input, and you're coming through the repeater. Go right ahead.
Okay. How is it? Whoops, wrong button. Wait a minute. How is it this way? You copy me here, okay, also?
That was the right button. You sound beautiful. Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, I'm at home. That's why. But I'm on a horizontal beam, sort of aimed in your direction. Yeah, we kind of got off the topic here, but it is related to noise figure. And I was going to mention to the repeater person my experience in tuning, especially in a noisy environment, and where the 7.6 repeater is, we have a couple of 50 kilowatt FM stations within a mile, and I've measured off the 2 meter resonant antenna coming through the duplexer out of band signals that are still, you know, like plus 10 dBm, which are incredible. Anyway, best way to do it is use one of those isolated injectors ahead of the duplexer, and then you can measure your real effective sensitivity with and without the antenna connected, and you'll find out how bad it is. But that's not my question. Wait a minute.
B2HWW. I understand completely. You timed out the node and I had to reconnect.
Okay, sorry if that's timed out, but Dick, you an HP8970A noise figure meter, a friend of mine, Pete Odio, who I think you know, got some of these radio telescope type cavity hemp set front end preamps, which have an extremely narrow bandwidth, when I say at 2 meters, probably 100, maybe 200 kilohertz bandwidth, and he puts it on his noise figure meter, and of course it reads next to zero, or less than it should be. And I was trying to explain to him that its noise bandwidth is so much less than the detection bandwidth that it's confusing the noise figure meter, because it's expecting the noise effective bandwidth of the preamp to be greater or equal to the detection bandwidth in the noise figure meter. And nowhere in their HP spec do they ever mention what the bandwidth is, but I said to them it's probably the standard 3 megahertz equivalent, or 2 to 3 megahertz. So I told him he should measure it in a simple fashion. But I just want to get your last comments on that. But I think that's the assumption that I made, that the preamp is so narrow compared to the bandwidth of the detector that it's confusing it. Go ahead.
I'm waiting for a reset tone. Okay. The automatic noise figure system, from the noise source, through the preamp, through the total of 70 dB of gain, into the front panel, if this is the best of all worlds, everything should have 3 megacycles of noise equivalent bandwidth or more. And if you really had a filter that's only 100 kc wide at 144 megs, there's at least two disadvantages of that, and that is, opposite of common sense, when you make a filter more and more narrow, and it's got individual poles that are finite in their Q, the more and more narrow bandwidth means they are very lightly loaded resonators, and therefore the total insertion loss goes up fast. You make a filter 100 or 200 kc wide at 2 meters, you're literally making it a loaded Q of 1400, and it's easily going to have a dB or two of insertion loss of that filter. So therefore, the noise figure you measure better be at least a dB or two higher than reality just from that alone. Now, another thing to worry about is that with this preamplifying filter that's only letting 100 or 200 kc wide noise getting into the preamp, and the preamp and everything downrange is multiple megacycles wide, it means that a hell of a lot of the noise that the detector of the automatic noise figure indicator is using, the synchronous demodulator, the Dickey switch, the radiometer, it is flipping on and off sources of noise that do not include the front end. I mean, if it's 3 megacycles wide and only 300 kilohertz of it is from that which passes through the filter, that means that 99% of the noise did not come from the front end. It came from other stages. And as those other stages get modulated by whatever, without a doubt it can create confusion. So you can get yourself, I'm not saying it's impossible, but you can get yourself in a fair amount of trouble by having too narrow a system way up front, but broadband downrange with 70 dB of gain total. Reminds me also what I've seen when people cascade a whole lot of amplifiers because they want a whole lot of gain all on one frequency. They're really asking for, let me drop. They're asking for the whole system to easily break into oscillation, number one. And number two, if you're using amplifiers that are a few gigahertz wide, and I have, pretty soon the total noise power of all of the gain across multiple gigahertz turns into so many milliwatts that the final stage of amplification is going into limiting on just your noise power of your amplifier strength. In a situation like that, you may have to put individual intermediate stage filters to limit the noise bandwidth to make sure that doesn't happen. I've seen people have a system that is what they call hard limited. It limits on its own amplification noise even before you put in any signal or other source of noise. Now, there's a place where that can have certain advantages in a particular kind of a jamming environment. But That's not where you and I operate. Now, let me get back to, I know that Mel had some further questions on noise figure. And by the way, noise figure is not a simple subject. When you hear these details of automatic noise figure indication, the way it works, its vulnerability, its susceptibility, its power. And by the way, when Howie was saying he injects with a 50 dB attenuator, he only needs 20 or 25 dB of attenuation on the injection port so that the straight through port has 0.01 dB of loss, so to speak. And that's good enough. You don't have to go down to a 50 dB coupling coefficient. 25 is enough, in my opinion, to be injecting signal and noise into a system when you're tuning it in the real world environment. But now I know Mel had some further questions. And as I said before, automatic noise figure indicating is an art and science. There's a zillion ways you can do it wrong, very few ways you can do it right. If you haven't been there and done it a few times, there's a whole bunch of minefield traps you can fall into. Done correctly, though, it can give you a tuning accuracy of your low noise receiving system that is second to none. K2KEY, K2LIW in the tech net.
This is K2KEY. No, I was just thinking. And I know I get myself into trouble when I start thinking. But as you said, burn some wood. If we take a circuit, there's two things I just quite, you know, maybe I'm not on the right track. But okay, let's say we take a system, a circuit, a device, whatever you want to call it. And if we make the noise figure of the device, is equal to its attenuation. Is that a viable way of designing? In other words, you kept saying the noise figure. Let's say you said 3 dB noise figure. That's a factor. In other words, you're putting in a factor of 2 to find the power as a noise figure. In other words, let's say we had a 3 dB attenuation situation, and the noise figure was 3 dB. So in other words, can we automatically put it through a design so that the noise factor is some way equal to the attenuation of the design? Is that a possible design? Is that correct design, or am I just a little bit off the center? Over.
Yeah, at first it sounds good, Mel, but it's not good enough. Assume that I had a damn good receiver sitting in the shack. Nice low noise figure, good dynamic range, proper tuning, good synthesizer, everything's working great. But for some reason, I must run a 3 dB loss cable between that shack, good receiver, and my antenna on top of the tower. Come hell or high water, I gotta have 3 dB of loss in that cable. Common sense would lead you to believe that if I put a preamplifier up at the antenna with 3 decibels of gain, I would overpower the 3 dB of loss of the antenna, and I'd be back to an ideal receiver. Good common sense would lead you to believe that. Absolutely, positively not true. You use the cascaded noise figure formula, first on the ideal receiver, then on the receiver with a 3 dB loss cable to it, which is how exactly 3 dB higher noise figure than the receiver in the shack. Then you put 3 dB of gain with a 0 dB noise figure up there, and you think you're going to come back to where you were in the shack. The answer is no. It's a law of diminishing returns. That noise created by the cable, unless the cable is cryogenically cooled, and you and I don't have the resources to do that, that cable is sitting at room temperature, 295 Kelvin or whatever, 70 degrees Fahrenheit. It is generating noise. By the way, the noise it generates, let me drop. And here's another thing about noise that's not common sense. The noise it generates is the product of its insertion loss and its physical temperature. If you can make its insertion loss of the cable, you're going to use 6-inch diameter Andrew Heliax that has 0 dB of loss. That cable could be blazing hot and it generates no noise. You can use a very lossy piece of cable. And if you can cryogenically cooling it to 0 degrees Kelvin, even though it's got loss, it'll generate no noise. I know that sounds crazy. So it's the product of its insertion loss and its physical temperature that makes the cable generate noise. So the cable is generating noise. And if I had 3 dB of gain in my preamplifier driving the 3 dB loss cable, I've now made the signal and the noise of the cable equal to each other. I'm 3 dB away from ideal. My rest of my receiver system is still going to see that noise. If I use 20 dB of gain in that preamplifier, assuming I don't overload the rest of the receiver downrange, I've now got 20 dB of extra gain overriding 3 dB of noise, and my total impact of that cable might now be a tenth of a dB instead of 3 dB. But it's a law of diminishing returns. It's an asymptotic situation. You never completely get rid of the noise of the cable unless you had infinite dB of gain in front of it. You don't have to go anywhere near that far. Usually 20 dB of more gain than the loss of the device overrides all but a very small amount. So there's some very non-common sense here. Use that cascading noise figure formula multiple times correctly, you will actually start seeing these phenomena. Bear in mind that when you use that automatic noise figure formula, with that cascaded noise figure formula, noise figure total of the system equals, let me drop, F1 plus F2 minus 1 over gain 1 plus F3 minus 1 over gain 1, gain 2, and so on. That cascaded noise figure formula works if and only if every one of the numbers you use in that formula are hard anti-decibel numbers, real numbers. You got to take all of your dBs and convert them back into real numbers to use that formula. When you finally get a calculated overall noise figure from that formula, then you can take 10 log of that number and convert it back to decibels of noise figure if you like. Or you can use another set of mathematics and convert it into degrees Kelvin. Degrees Kelvin of equivalent noise figure, noise temperature of your receiver system is, in some minds, a more accurate, more precise way of describing how good your preamp is. If I buy a real good S-band preamplifier for my television receive-only terminal at 3.8 to 4.2 gigahertz, a real good one these days will be measured at 18 degrees Kelvin. That may turn out to be something like 0.15 dB noise figure, and they think it's more accurate to call it 18 Kelvin. So these real low noise figure numbers, they tend to rate in Kelvin. And yet the crazy people, when it comes to a KU band amplifier, rate it in dBs, not in degrees Kelvin. It doesn't make sense all the time. You got to hear all this jazz multiple times before it sinks in and starts making any sense, Mel. The first few times you hear it, I know you're going to say, what in the world is going on here? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, yeah, you're right. If you don't constantly work with this, I see the confusion. Yes, now I see how sensitivity now also works into this, and that's how I understand how we, of course, use 10 times the log, or in other words, the signal to noise ratio equals 10 dB. I see how that is now comes as the common figure that you see as 10 times that log or 10 dB, Dick. And now, so in other words, very closely related to the noise floor, or whatever you want to call it, is actually sensitivity. Am I correct? Over.
Without a doubt, whatever you do to the system to lower the electronic noise temperature, your system will be more sensitive. Common sense would lead you to believe that if I've got a terrestrial communication system, I get an antenna looking at the horizon, where half the antenna's forward lobe is looking up at cold sky, 3 degrees Kelvin. The other half is looking down at hot Earth, 300 degrees Kelvin. Therefore, the antenna temperature is approximately 152 degrees Kelvin, if the antenna is ideal. Common sense would lead you to believe that if I got 152 degree Kelvin antenna temperature, that if I connected to a preamplifier connected to that antenna, that if the antenna and preamplifier has 152 degrees Kelvin, that I've broken even and everything's hunky-dory. Not true. In that environment, half of the noise that I receive coming out of my loudspeaker is coming from the antenna, and half of it is coming from my own electronics. I can make a 3 decibel improvement if I take my 150 degree Kelvin electronics and bring it down to 0 degrees Kelvin. If I did that, I'd be going from, oh, something like a 1.5 dB noise figure down to 0. So I'm making a 1.5 dB noise figure change in the noise figure of the preamplifier, but I get a 3 dB noise figure signal-to-noise ratio improvement. cryogenic systems, what meaning by my definition of cryogenic, anything connected to an antenna or a front end, let me drop, which is colder than 290 Kelvin, colder than room temperature, whether the antenna, the feed line, the preamplifier, if anything is colder than room temperature, you could loosely defined call it cryogenic. Once you enter the world of cryogenics, decibels of noise figure and signal-to-noise ratio do not obey a linear law. The only thing that's linear is degrees Kelvin. The total system in degrees Kelvin, every time you have it, you've made 3 dB improvement. I could have a 10 degree Kelvin system, a tenth of a dB noise figure, and I do something to bring it down to a 5 degree Kelvin, I went from a tenth of a dB to 0.05 dB. I made 0.05 dB of change in the noise figure. I've half the degrees Kelvin, I've half the total noise power coming out of that receiver, I've made a 3 decibel improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. It ain't linear. If I'm doing laboratory measurements with a room temperature signal generator, room temperature attenuators, room temperature electronics, now every decibel of change I make in noise figure will be exactly 1 decibel of change in signal-to-noise ratio in that laboratory. But go to a real antenna that's looking at cold sky, and I enter the world of cryogenics. Nothing in decibels is linear anymore. Only degrees Kelvin are linear. Hard lesson to learn, but believe me, it's a kind of a truth. And now you know some of the reason why the serious scientists in the world of cryogenics of real low-noise amplifying systems treat everything in degrees Kelvin. The radio astronomers do, certainly. I bet you've got some more questions about all of this, George. W2VMV, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, WK2VMV. No, I'm in the around this, arena one time. But comment that what, Pete is using is one of these front ends where the quarter wave cavity, pipe, silver plated and stuff with the 50 ohm cap for the existence of the ground band at the top is where it's coupled into the hemp set. And it's got about a 0.2 dB or slightly less, maybe 0.18 dB noise figure. He primarily makes them for radio astronomy. So when Pete measured it on his 8970A, of course it was like or something very close to zero, and he was confused about it. And I said I contended that that's a very narrow bandwidth of noise compared to the measurement system, and it's exactly what you're saying, that the system is measuring all the other noise, even though he puts it in the calibrate mode and uses the appropriate calibration factor and noise source. So anyway, you just basically confirmed I wanted to just check because I knew you were the resident expert in this area, having worked on it for basically most of your life.
George, tell me with your microphone what you're doing. Rock your antenna a couple of degrees to the right and a couple of degrees to the left. Every antenna has something called Condon lobe. Someday I'll explain what that all means, polarization-wise. Because you've got a horizontal antenna, when you bore sighted on the repeater, you're cross-polarized and it's giving you quite a bit of dropout. You rock it a couple of degrees to the right or the left. I'll tell you which way to stop, and you're going to get a much stronger signal into the repeater. Go ahead and do that, George.
Okay, how am I now? I just moved it around. I was not peaked on the repeater. I figured my signal was good enough. I didn't want to have to run 300 watts, so I'm okay now.
You're a little bit better. Rock it 2, 3, 4 degrees to the right, 2, 3, 4 degrees to the left. Tell me what you're doing. I'm hearing you dead full quieting, 60 dB out of the noise on the input. Therefore, I'll be able to tell you when you hit the right spot. Go ahead.
Okay. Right now, I'm at 250. I'll kick down here. Here's 245. I'll go back up through 250, 250, it's 255, over.
You started off at 250, and boy, you were dead full quieting to the machine. That's the right number. Go ahead.
Yeah, that pretty much is where I peaked. So, okay. So did you get, I guess you got most of what I said, or all of it.
Yes, I did, but only 70% of what you said came through the machine, and it was dropping out intermittently. So, yeah, that experiment that you and Pete Manfrey were running, W-H-O-O-D-O, with his Hewlett-Packard automatic noise figure indicator, I think you're saying he sometimes got negative numbers, which are not real. A lot of people have thought they can get negative noise figure. Never in decimals can you get a negative noise figure. Never as a hard number can you get noise figure below unity, which really equals 0 dB. And calibration factors, where he was using a couple of hundred KC wide filter at 2 meters, by definition, it had to have a couple of dB of insertion loss, unless it was as big as a house. And so narrow filters must have insertion loss. That has to add directly to the noise figure if everything was being measured correctly. And there's ways you can crank that back out, so to speak, but on top of that, every noise figure setup has a secondary noise figure which can be evaluated. So unless your preamp has got a zillion dB of gain, its noise figure and gain is driving a secondary stage, the rest of the system, into the noise figure meter, which is creating a detriment which gives you a slightly pessimistic answer. A smart guy measures gain as well as apparent noise figure, applies it to a formula to calculate what the real noise figure of the preamp is. I wonder if you guys got that deep into it. Back to you, George.
Yes and no. As I said, this thing has about a 20 dB of gain. And there's no filter on the output, of course. It's strictly the quarter wave on the input. And it's a pretty impressive device. The quarter wave pipe is about 2 inches in diameter, and the semiconductor is the appropriate device for this. The right impedance match, but it's also deflated, so it's got pretty good low loss. And anyway, he's going through the effort to improve his EME station. Because I think he spoke to you about he was going to do cross-polarized antennas. But now he's going to rotate his polarization. That's another whole story. So, anyway, I'm not going to hold it with the net. Thank you for your information, and to the net and everybody else. And I'll sign out of here for the time being and catch you guys later. K2RIW, WHVNV.
Bye-bye, George. Check in with us more often. We ought to find out what Paul's going to say from what's going on in space. Let me turn it over quickly first to Mel. If you have any further comments on what you and I were discussing, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, just in closing, Dick, I did say it's getting late. We want to turn it over to Paul. But when they have on a receiver to have a specification that I know a number of people ask me, really, what does it mean? I think we've gotten down to almost the point of what that is, that when they have that specification, the MVS, which is, I guess, the minimum detectable signal. In other words, that is basically what we talk about, that we're talking, and I sum it up and say, that is when the noise floor is basically equal to the signal level. In other words, noise floor and signal level are equal. We'll call that, is that the legitimate meaning of MVS 6? Before in closing, just make that comment, and then we'll go over to Paul. Over.
Now, most people do call a minimum discernible signal. A few people call a minimum detectable signal. In the case of a spectrum analyzer, you've got it exactly right. When the signal equals the noise power, signal power in the resolution bandwidth equals the noise power, and your spectrum analyzer is sweeping across that steady state signal, the signal is not being modulated in any way, it's just a simple dead carrier signal, you will see a bump on the screen of exactly 3 decibels in the vicinity of that signal. And the bump will have the rounded edges that shows the shape of the top of your resolution bandwidth filter. So it's kind of funny to think about this, but there's always a certain amount of noise figure going into your last stage of detection of a spectrum analyzer. A good spectrum analyzer's got darn close to 120 decibels of gain from the front panel to the final detector that gets displayed on that screen. There's around 120 dB of gain, so there is noise there, and you will see that noise as sort of grass on the bottom of the screen. And when that grass picks up by 3 dB, and you use enough video filtering, then the noise you're putting in from all of your stages of amplification to the final detector and the signal that you're putting in there are equal to each other. And when you add two equal things together, you get twice the power. Twice the power is a 3 decibel increase. Do you see a 3? That's the rating for minimum discernible signal on a spectrum analyzer. Now, what is the definition of minimum discernible signal for a amateur radio receiver? That's partially a function of, are you talking about the, let me drop. Are we talking about the sideband mode, the FM mode? Are we talking about SINAD, 20 dB of quieting, 12 dB of SINAD? Those are some of the definitions for minimum acceptable signal, I'm going to call it. That's a signal that's going to give you rather good sounding, not perfect hi-fi, not decibel quieting, but good sounding audio. 12 dB of SINAD and 20 dB of quieting. The average person will say, I can hear that for hours, particularly if it's an interesting speaker, and that's good enough for me. But that's not minimum. When you and I measure the absolute threshold of a repeater, we quite often talk about the squelch break. We set the squelch control very carefully, and we crank up the signal generator in the center of the IF strip until the receiver breaks squelch. That's one definition. And in many cases, that breaking of squelch probably is around 3 dB of signal plus noise to noise ratio. But there, I'm not sure. I'm not sure everyone's got the same definition of what's the weakest possible signal. A boom bounce enthusiast will listen to a signal that is 3 dB below the noise. And he'll give the guy in the TMO reporting system, he'll give him not a T, which stands for trace, to probably give him an M, not an O, which means I'm getting every single letter. They'll probably give him the middle of the three possible choices when the signal is a couple of decibels below the noise. A guy with a good set of hearing who really understands Morse code and the flutter you get off that moon will take a signal that's below the noise into his hearing system. He says, that's good enough. I get that full set of calls. I got that Rogers. That's a QSO. You talk to an FM guy who's using repeaters and he hears a little bit of noise in the background. He says, I don't want to talk to you anymore. You've got a noisy signal. There's huge differences in criteria of what's an acceptable amount of signal-to-noise ratio. Thank you for any comments on that, Mel. Then we got to go over to Paul. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, Roger. I'm just not going to really get much more into it because I heard of a very, very unusual discussion one time on this, and came to mind that they said that noise source circuits. Circuits that inherent the inherent noise of it. That is why they said that if modern circuitry would use transformer coupling in the design, it would be better or quieter than if they use resistors and resist the network in the design. And this one guy was trying to market an ultra quiet. And he says it is due to the use of transformers from stage to stage. And I wonder, is this really why they have, more or less, used blue toroid, are they inherently quieter than if we use some other method, Dick, in Hartford's thinking? Is that really the answer, that rather than use the old-fashioned IF, that they put, if you put toroid or a little, if they're enclosed, basically the field's enclosed in itself, that they are being quieter than some of the older designs? Is this really true over?
Now, you're onto something here, Mel. In the old days, we had IF cans with real primary and secondary windings. Every one of the stages of our IF strip, and maybe even the RF amplifier, at the equivalent of an RF can, they were transformer isolated from stage to stage. And that can give you a significant amount of what's called humbucking, 60-cycle noise rejection, other sources of noise rejection, power supply noise rejection, and so on. And so you could build a receiver today with toroid primary secondary transformers all over the place. You don't have to. When I built that super sensitive 10 to the minus 5 picofarad detecting circuit of a 1 picofarad capacitor, what I used were inexpensive, exotic Texas Instruments fully dual differential op amp. Let me drop. What those dual differential op amps were is they had differential input, a plus and minus input terminal to the operational amplifier on each stage. Everybody's familiar with that. Most operational amplifiers have only one output terminal. You pay a little bit more money for a good set of TI, among other brand names, operational amplifiers that are fully dual differential. They have a pair of output connectors. One's a positive and one's a negative. And they're fully balanced. So now you've got two or three cascaded stages of operational amplifier where everything's running push-pull on the input of every stage, everything's running push-pull on the output of every stage, and if you buy a good enough set of op amps that have got a very high common mode rejection ratio, electronically you have all the benefit of having transformer coupling between all the stages. It's got humbucking and noise bucking and power supply rejection up the kazoo. You wouldn't believe how quiet that thing can be. That's part of how I was able to get that kind of performance. So you can get the equivalent of that in tiny little integrated circuits that are properly built these days. Ain't that something else, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, roger, roger. Let me let it drop. Okay, Dick, we better go over. It's getting around 10:30. We can continue this all night long. So let's go over to Paul and all, and then we'll pick up some other stuff here because, like you say, you know, it's getting on in time. And we'll pick up on this, like you say, at another time, Dick, a little bit more time, a little earlier. K2RIW in the group. This is K2KEY.
Good suggestion. The latest issue of Newsday, or maybe two issues ago, had some beautiful pictures taken from the International Space Station of the docking that took place. The female commander of the station we have at this time. And so I bet you some good things are going on. I hear tell that one of the electrical power supplies or one of the chunks of electronics wasn't working quite correctly, but they did a spacewalk and installed it anyhow. So give us a few more words along these lines, Paul. WS2N. Hope we haven't put you to sleep with all the chat. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Speak to the subject matter, Dick.
Yeah, hold.
Another station, Dick.
Yeah, hold on, Howie. Mel, Howie, we're going to come back to the subject after the Paul's report. Go ahead, Paul, with yours.
Yeah, good. This WS1. Yeah, Endeavor's. I've been up there. It's going to be a 16-day record flight for space shuttle Endeavour STS-123. They can do that now. You can go longer than the normal 12 or 13 days. They can extend it now three days longer than they used to. Now that they are able to tap the power off the solar arrays of the International Space Station. They have enough of them up there not only to supply enough power for the space station, but they have extra power that they could jump back into the space shuttle, they experimented with this last couple of flights. It's the first time they're really having an extended flight with that capability. With that, they're also able to have 5 spacewalks. That's a record amount. Most they usually have is 4. So the extended time they're able to do that. Need that time outside the spacecraft to do the work. A couple of spacewalks dedicated to installing the robot, Dexter, they call it Dexter the robot, and then the other 3 spacewalks were dedicated to the Kaibo, part 1 of the Japanese work laboratory platform, Robert. So those 2 parts were brought up, part 1 of the Kaibo, and also the Dexter robot. Talked about a little bit like last week. The Dexter robot is this gigantic 12-foot robot. It has 2 arms on it. And the shoulders are about 8 feet apart. You can idea how big this thing is. The arms are 12 feet long. I think there's about 7 joints in each arm. And it's able to twist at its weight when attached to the space station. And the idea of the robot is to work that a lot of the astronauts have been doing outside the space station. To replace that time with the robot, it would be a lot more work to be done with a lot less human spacewalk. So it went well. They had a power supply problem. And then they sent up a software patch, and then they apparently, I don't know if that worked or not, but they decided to bypass this problem. They're trying to power up the robot. But whatever they did, apparently it worked. The thing is being put together, built by Canada, some $200 million piece of equipment. It's the 3rd part of the robotic system. The idea is to complement this whole space station with this whole set of the 1st part being Canada Arm 2, the 50-foot arm that's able to inch one square across the space station. By that I mean it attaches on one part of the space station, it grabs onto another part of the space station, picks up power from that part, and then it's able to disconnect and go to another part, and then move equipment around, or even habitats around to a different location. The problem with that is those have to be attached on one, one arm has to be attached. Now with this thing, if you attach Dexter robot to handle the robotic arm, you will now have 2 arms to be able to operate the work. Each arm has multiple tools attached to it, different types of tools, cameras all over,
repeaters, timeout.
The third part of this robotic system, you have Canada Arm 2, you got the Dexter, the robot, you got this mobile transport unit, which rides along the length of all these 11 trusses that have been assembled in space to support all the different radiators that are attached to the space station to get rid of heat, or the gigantic solar panels that are attached this little top that rides across from one end to the other, carrying not only the Canada ROM 2, but now it also carry the deck for the robot. By the way, if you look up deck for the robot, it's D-E-X-T-R-E. If you look up on Google, by Canada, but the name is, they call it Dexter. So I thought it was pretty interesting that they got this thing all up and running. I'm anxious to see how it works in the future. One other space topic I thought might be important to mention. After the space shuttle is retired in 2010, we need about 9 more flights to complete the International Space Station. Officially, the space station is 50% built. They've got a lot of different modules to bring up. Cupola, which is a lookout area, gigantic window for the astronauts. To make this thing complete, they're coming along. They have a permanent 3-person crew within... Within 1 year, they're going to have a permanent 6-person crew on board. The space station should be completed by 2010 September. But to do that, they need to at least 9 more flights. This year alone, they plan another 4 flights for the space station. There'll be a few more flights after those 9 flights. General maintenance type of flights, and of course crew exchange flights will continue until the year 2010 September. You're going to have a low of maybe 3, 4, 5 years even before you send the United States sends astronauts back up to space for the Constellation program. Drop it. This is WSUN for the space portion of the TechNet. The Orion spacecraft is going to be the one that really replaces the shuttle for human spaceflight. It will be attached to the Ares rocket. It will be built to Ares rocket. There's two forms of Ares rockets that they'll have. One will be a gigantic setup, which will launch heavy equipment into space. Amount of weight that it'll bring, it'll be able to bring up as equivalent to the amount of weight that the Apollo Saturn V is going to bring up, subsequent down. The manned vehicle, the Orion, will be launched by an Ares rocket. The Orion spacecraft has been duplicated already, a mock-up version of it. Within a couple of months, we plan on bringing that to White Sands, New Mexico, and attaching it to a temporary type of rocket launch setup. What they plan on doing first with this thing is loading it up with electronics, computers, all kinds of sensing equipment. Help people, and putting on top of it a solid group of rockets mounted on a tower, on top of the spacecraft. If anybody hasn't seen it, the Orion spacecraft is about 15 feet in diameter, much bigger than the Apollo spacecraft, but it has that same shape, shape as the Apollo spacecraft, triangular type of look to it, shields and all. Much bigger. Be able to carry a crew of 6, where with the Apollo, you carried a crew of 3. There's a lot more room. But they do want to test it, of course. They plan on launching it for the test the abort system. They want to see how that works. It'll go up a couple miles. They're going to have a big parachute. Parachute up in the 10 feet in diameter, it's going to pop out of the this mock-up of the Orion spacecraft. It'll float down to the ground. And they'll run a couple of tests like that, but they're getting there, little by little. They're actually building or completing hardware for the beginning of the new Constellation program, which consists of the Orion spacecraft, Ares launch vehicles, external tank setup for cargo, part of the system, and eventually a little lander, which will be launched on this heavy lift vehicle. And they plan on going to the moon. That's what they want to do. They'll just put that on unmanned cargo, Ares launcher, and that will be put in orbit. Take their four astronauts and put the Orion, Ares, and launching system. That will be launched into orbit. And they'll dock them in Earth orbit with the attached boost
repeater. Time out. Repeater. Time out. Cancel.
Paul, wasn't there also a interesting mission where the Cassini flew by one of its moons and detected water vapor in the plume from the geysers coming out of that moon? I wonder if you happened to see that report this week. Go ahead.
I know they were going to send the Cassini through the water plume. That was the Enceladus, the moon with the water plume coming out of it. That's one story recently from the Cassini SAT mission. The other story was they found rain around Rhea. Rhea is the second largest around SAT. Night being the first. And it's the first because it's the first moon that they found rain going around. We have rains around SAT. They found rains over the years around Jupiter. Much, much finer. Much harder to see, but they're there, as well as Uranus and Neptune also have rings. But as far as moons go, they've actually been exploring stuff around that moon. But yeah, I haven't found out how that went. I know that moon Enceladus is suspected to supply a lot of debris or material to part of the ring system of Saturn. Those rings, they've established many different sources. But this one is still being built, the ring system, from what they see, the pool of water. You've got heating going on inside that. You've got tidal effects. All the different moons going around it. You've got the pull of gravity of Saturn. You've got the external moons going around, pulling out the moon one way, or then the planet pulling back another way. It's kind of like picking a paper clip and bending it back and forth. Plus, it gets hot after a while. You can actually feel it. That's what's going on inside that moon. Creating that effect. So I did read that they were going to do it. I didn't read about the results yet. Back to WS.
WATCH CDO.
Go ahead, Andy.
Sorry to interrupt. Paul, I got a quick question. What frequency are you transmitting into on the repeater? Are you on the east end or the west end?
Oh no, I'm transmitting directly to the repeater 146.250. I mean, I walk around the house with the HD, and it's a great addition, great feature. I can walk outside, walk the dog, and never miss a bit of the net handy back.
Well, I'm asking because your signal is breaking up, and I just want to know if it's you or if it's the something else. You're going in on 146.250? There's no beat, go ahead.
I'm turning my beam, maybe conditions. I'm turning the beam a little bit. Any better?
It cleared up a little bit, but I couldn't tell. Okay. Because if you want, going on the east end, and I want to, you know, if you're having trouble, try that, because I know you're pretty far east. Try going in on the east end, and it should sound better, because your signal is breaking up quite a bit.
Okay, I'm doing, right now, I'm turning that beam the best I could. Probably conditions. Usually I don't have a problem in here. This is probably good.
Yeah, what are you talking about, Andy? I mean, Mel, here we go, Paul. Is that you could be going in on the 147.375.975 repeater. Right now, they are linked together. How about you, Paul?
I realize that, but I didn't know I was breaking up. Usually, I've always thought of a dead post widening the way it is. But yeah, oh sure. I'll go into the. I could always go into the cell phone machine, but even with my HD. So, okay, Dick. Very good. Yeah, I'm on 55 watts out. Using the pushcraft 10 element beam. Vertically polarized, pointing toward the North Shore Towers. I don't know. But yeah, if I have problems in the future, I'll go over the cell and back to you.
It sounds to me like you have some breakup of, or there's a crackly sound, like there's a loose connection somewhere. As the wind blows, it breaks up. We're hearing everything you're saying, just that the noise is varying quite a bit. I think Dick will concur on that.
Yeah, George had the identical sound, Andy. George is in, I think, Port Jefferson. Paul is in Ronkonkoma. So everybody that far out east, when they transmit to the repeater tonight, I think the repeater has got a little bit of crackly noise on its input, and somebody's not giving them a potent signal. Back to you, Andy.
You're full quieting. No problem on your signal. Okay, I just wanted to know. And Paul, if you want to swing over to the other repeater, try it that way. And, because I know the other one was having a similar problem, that's what I wanted to know. I didn't mean to interrupt, just wanted to find out. Go ahead, Dick.
Keep forgetting there's no, the method by which you get in creates no beat. Okay, I thank you for that call. And I'm Mel. I think it's time that you dip into your mailbag or dip into your bag of questions. Choice is yours. K2KEY, KQLIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. The distance that I am from the repeater site, would it be the same equivalent distance, say, that Paul is from the repeater site from out, you know, the way east of it? I would be, I guess, somewhat west of the repeater. Well, exactly, I guess, somewhat southwest of the repeater. Does my signal show up with the same kind of noise out of Brooklyn, Dick, over?
No, you're dead for quieting to my QTH, to the repeater, as I hear it. I think Paul is further out, and he's got some mountains in between. To my knowledge, he does not have line of sight. You, I think, have line of sight to the repeater. So that's a factor. Mel, go ahead.
I wouldn't call it mountainous, but there's quite a bit of buildings. There is a mountain, because if you look at the topography of Brooklyn, as you go towards Eastern Parkway, it rises up quite a bit. You know, I am at sea level, and a good part of further downtown Brooklyn is considerably higher than I am, Dick, over.
Okay, I've never, with rare exception, I've never heard any noise on your signal, Mel.
Okay, because I'm using just a simple, very simple ground plane antenna that is a, just stuck on a yard arm off about 35, 40 feet off the tower. Okay, anyhow. Okay, let's see. Yeah, I just was looking. I just had so many things here to do today, you know. I got involved here with this and that. Morning with the net, and got into a little conversation this afternoon. So then I started fooling with this goddamn light system here in the house, which always gets, for some reason, screwed up something awful every time we have to change the clock. Never get this thing right for so I keep playing with it. Here's a question from the guys on 75.